so why don't you guys buckle up and join the ride, because we're going to have some fun
going green.
And Abby said, you shouldn't commit illegal acts, except perhaps at night and with your parents' permission.
Your advice is making less sense than usual.
Well, the important thing is family and friendship, honesty, values, and no one got arrested.
You see this jerk? This is the same thing. Kropotkin was the same jerk, and Bakunin was the same jerk. Not good. Not good, I'm telling you.
He was a very good dancer.
He's a low-life.
George Orwell, who definitely didn't like socialism of any kind, warned us against this. He wrote books that said that totalitarianism is bad and that sticking with old ideas is good.
I got news for you. You gotcha. The Yale population again.
I did not know that.
I never thought you'd lose a Stalin debate.
You never expect to walk into one.
Sure.
Avoid Marxism. Or telling her you're a Trotskyite.
Trotskyist. Only Stalinists would call the Trotskyist a Trotskyite. And I'm not a Trotskyist anymore. I'm a Maoist.
Relentlessly anti-Trump and relentlessly pro-somebody like Obama.
I'm not pro-Obama. I've been a critic of Obama. I'm a critic of the Democratic Party.
Because
I'm literally a communist.
Well, you know how it is. The main thing is to get those juicy likes and subscribes. And we can get some more of that sweet, sweet communist money rolling in. You know how it is, bro. Gotta get that communist dollar. Gotta make it to the top.
Just imagine somebody saying under cannibalism or under slavery or under dictatorship, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Well, they'd be wrong. There is something you can do about it. You can get beyond these archaic systems and move closer and closer to fulfilling human capacities. And that's what we need to do.
But it's all for good reason, because I have in the studio with me, I'm your host, Dan Platt, with Michael Walsh. Say hi.
I run the Facebook page Homegrown Socialist, and I'm here on the Three Lefts show, who's in anything of perspective, for the curious or the committed, promoting a post-cap direct democracy and a commons economy, a left that is of itself and for itself, the meeting point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. This show proudly waves the flags of the three lefts.
Nicely done. Okay, are you ready to be blackpilled? Let's start the show down. But also, opportunity. So this is from Forbes. You know, when the capitalists reporters are panicking, you know it's time to hunker down. The story is Stock Market Crash 2020. Welcome to the end game. The end game of capitalism. Could it actually be as Marx predicted? I don't know.
I can only hope.
But we have to be organized to do something to fill in the void. Otherwise it's gonna be feudalism or something like that. Necromancy.
Technocracy.
So this is filed by Clem Chambers, senior contributor. He's part of the Intelligent Investing Contributor Group. Whatever. Because he's covering the stock market, of course. Now, this chart doesn't make you think the crash is coming soon. Probably nothing will. It has gone vertical. By vertical, meaning going up vertically. But this is usually a spike that then is following down. Because the last time it did go up vertically, it was right before the last recession. The NASDAQ is on its final run and is going vertical. A classic end of bubble move. This is trader heaven and turns into speculator hell. For those who think that markets do grow to the skies, it could go up a long way in price, but it won't go for long in time. It could last to Christmas. It could fold tomorrow. But my feeling is that unless this bubble is cut down by the Fed, the final move will be large and quick. You can refer to the dot-com crash for the general shape of what looks possible next. Attempts by the government to pump up the economy with new money is resulting in it going straight into equities and straight into the tip of the equity sphere, the giant high beta stock story stocks. This is a malfunction in the quantitative easing, although it's what has happened in the past, which supports asset prices and slowly trickles the benefits of this support down the pyramid of wealth. Now the game is up because the new money is going straight into this bubble of financial assets. Oh, who could have guessed that would happen? And that are spiraling up out of control. If we now get a NASDAQ bull vertical, that is the end of the chapter of the process. It will be followed by a devastating crash as everyone dashes to the exit in a blaze of wealth destruction. Wealth that never really existed, I guess, except in our own labor. The Federal Reserve needs to get a lid on this fast, and it appears to be trying to by tapering its balance sheet. But the bubble is still fizzing, and if it does not stop soon, it will do what bubbles generally do. Erupt, and then collapse. The final eruption before collapse looks to be underway, and we should only hope it doesn't happen. If it does enter the terminal bubble phase and then collapse, it will be the second blow to the U.S. and world economy, which repeats the 1930 narrative of the 1-2 punch of twin crises, followed by banking crisis. Here it will be lockdown, followed by stock market crash. It won't be hard to see it coming, because if the NASDAQ goes vertical, it will be hard to miss. Therefore, let's hope the Fed can keep a lid on it, because if we can't, we are in deep trouble. Folks, and the interesting, well, the thing is, it's like, we'd be happier if we had organized left that was like on the verge of just taking power, right? And then it's, we step in, or things are kaput, and then we can rebuild. Since banks are not going to be able to control how we do things. But it also means banks, so let's get on those alternative currencies, those alternative economics, all those community projects that are either still in vitro, or there maybe there's, it's been a long slog, 10 years there, 10 years there. But I suppose neither is nobody else. Something I'm always kind of critic channel is the slogan, nobody knows. How we get things done, anything good, anything valuable, anything memorable, is working together or taking things in a collective way. Individually, or maybe as mass groups, we don't know what we're doing. That goes for an unorganized left. It goes for the ruling classes that continue to fight over wedge issues or whether or not they can influence just enough of the voting population to squeak out another term for their relative side. What are your thoughts?
Well,
or is it too overwhelming? And
it's a bit overwhelming. I'm still a baby leftist, so mm-hmm. I'm still learning about all of the issues and all of the organizing issues that we face. But I am frankly terrified for the future. I am terrified about the potential of what can happen as fascism rises in this country, that we have a populist left and we have a populist right. The populist left,
you believe we have a populist right?
Well, I think that we have people.
We have a subculture.
A subculture. Mm-hmm. There are people who consider themselves populist right. I would generally agree that the figureheads of the populist right are fascists mm-hmm. and are using the power that the people have given them to take control. And it's kind of terrifying to see what is being normalized in this country right now.
Well, it seems the American neutral state is a... When this, if you're being cynical, it's all of humanity, but I'm not really keen to thinking this way, that there's a, everyone's neutral state is go along to get along. And this is where it kind of becomes, you can go down some pretty dark places and like, well, if we just get our minority of people in charge, then your little democratic values don't really mean anything. Everyone will still just go along to get along. That is what has happened when there's been revolutions, and that's still tyrannical or hierarchical because there wasn't, in fact, any actual social change. People weren't,
right,
quote unquote, ready or doing the work to move past going along to get along, which has to be done in very small steps, more or less, too. But, if things change really fast, then everyone else has to change their behavior fast. So if, just like with the Great Depression, Great Recession, which found people changing a little less, but at least in small groups, or demographics, we're changing our views on things, certainly, as well as how we work and how we view careers and retirement and all these things that basically as our institutions dissolve in front of our very eyes like a Thanos snap, and that's going to happen again. All these liberal institutions that our parents and so on and they're held so dear, they're under threat, and voting, getting Trump out of office is the way to save them. That's what makes my head spin of, yes, like, how do you believe that?
There's nothing wrong with our current system. The only thing wrong is Donald Trump. And once we get rid of him, everything will be fine and dandy.
But the generous way that I've heard it argued is then, not that it's like everything's fine, but it's the first step in making anything better. And I'm like, well, that's kind of what was said about Bush. We get Bush out and a Democrat in, and then we can make things better. And that's not what happened. So unless you consider the fact that clandestine movements like Occupy occurred, as in, but that wasn't you leading that, you know. But it does give the kind of, again, the boring but still necessary nonpartisan type of organizing that, say, but that's still on, say, using the status quo's structures. So, godfather of mine, you know, he was a Democratic committee person for a decade, which meant that as far as being the person that neighbors could talk to about what's going on, because he would get information. So people talk to him, his left-wing politics rub off on them, he changes minds, makes people a little less right-wing, reactionary. It's still under a Democratic guise, but that's because we're a one-party state town, one-party state, you know. So there's really no other game in town, as it's been called, and that phrase is going to come up again later. And for that, you know, they got a pretty progressive councilman that he would claim changed the way the city worked and made it quite a lot less corrupt, or at least somewhat less just smoke-filled back rooms where decisions are made and there's no Democratic input. But now the Democratic input just has to happen through interest groups. It actually created space for interest groups that we didn't even have before. That was just how machine-like it was. Just having interest groups is a step forward. Something that, like, was normal for, you know, 1950s. And the same goes for, like, actually having, like, races where you're just not electing someone based on, like, how much you like them or are they your friends. Platforms matter. Like, you know, I try to pick on platforms. I'm a very rare person. If everyone else is just like, are they like me enough? And if you talk to them enough, then they may see that you're more like them. And that's the hard, boring work that isn't flashy. It isn't even under a flag, except unless you're using the institutions that exist. But since they're so untrustworthy and you're basically getting co-opted into the sinking ship or the burning building, whatever metaphor you want to use, I just don't know how to kind of spare it except to do that boring work, but try to do it within the form of the independent left party, like the Greens. But I just have to actually do that work, which I'm sort of terrified of half the time. But I can do it. I'm less terrified if it's under the rubric of a campaign.
Right.
It's kind of an excuse to go around knocking on doors. But I've always had the ideas of going around knocking on doors out of campaign season or not in a campaign, but still doing what actual organizing looks like, which is asking people like what their needs are and saying we're a group and we're looking to solve them, which is something that none of these Black Lives Matter groups, not none of them, but I'm not aware that they're doing a lot of, because they're putting all their energy into just doing street demos, and at least in our area. And that's going to peter out, because eventually it's going through the motions. They're already kind of doing it. The pressure's kind of gone already. The pressure, I mean, it's so ironic that the pressure and the concessions are made after the violence. But then you start listening to liberals about how you need to be less violent or not condone when it's not you doing the window breaking, but saying that the window breaking matters.
Yeah, it's bullshit. The window breaking is why things are changing and why...
Or concessions are being made. Exactly. But once the concessions are made, then what next? And then you feel like you've won, or like, oh, now we can do the nuts and bolts organizing. But it's like, well, then how are you going to do it? You're going to do it with the people that gave you concessions. Or you're going to say, like, let's try to push them more. And then you're basically repeating the same cycle or the pattern that has been done for the last 30 years, the entire neoliberal project. That's how politics has been done.
Yeah, we're doing it on their terms. We need to somehow bring it onto our terms.
So I wanted to do the crisis is coming, crisis is, of course, here, but of everything else. But I want to put that in the context of, like, it's mentioned in that Forbes article, the 1930s paradigm. that we have an ascendant right wing. It's completely different as far as its form, because our political system is different than the Weimar Republic of Germany.
Right. And we have slightly stronger democratic institutions.
Suppose, but they're completely kind of rotted out as far as being money-based or social capital, if it isn't real capital, money capital. But I want to put that in context. So, like, the next rest of the hour or so, we're going to talk about splits in the left, which sounds completely random, but it's just like, well, this is kind of why what happened to the organized left in America or the world is there were a lot of splits over really kind of disagreements that shouldn't have had to have been deal breakers of, like, we can't work with you guys anymore because of various disagreements about that happen along the way each decade. So, for example, a split on is the Russian Revolution positive, right? You had a side that was like, well, this is what socialism is going to be, this is the form it's going to take, and we got to support it. And then you had others like anarchists that visited and said, no, this is just as bureaucratic, this is not what we want. And so there was a split between those two lefts. Then in the 30s, there was then a split between Trotsky and Stalin, so we'll be kind of covering that a bit. Then in the 40s, and then again after that, then there was a split of, like, Stalin, where it's like united front or keep doing our own thing. You know, we got to beat fascism, right? Got to vote for Joe Biden as a united front, right? Whether it would be this kind of socialist DSA or whatever, we all have to, like, be united front against fascism, and that means voting for Biden. Whoa. Well, that's what occurred at that time. That's what was done. And it basically meant that the organized left was in a weakened position after the war. And then the McCarthy era pretty much starts then in 48 with the Iron Curtain speech. And then it goes for 30 years and it ends with MLK and Malcolm X and all the other kind of socialist organizers being shot, jailed, or silenced, canceled. Losing their jobs, can't work as a teacher if you're a Socialist Party member, can't be in these organizations. Or the organizations get turned, and then, like, the CPUS or any type of named communist organization, they're actually, like, democratic shills. It's the oddest thing, and it's how you get, like, Angela Davis.
Yeah, I noticed that.
It's how you get people like Angela Davis, who is a great radical writer. Give it to her, of course. But I will still say, like, it's kind of – it doesn't seem to fit. Of, like, you're just going to vote Democrat your whole life.
Like, I saw that
still continue.
United States Communist Party had endorsed Hillary Clinton. And
they do that every cycle, by the way. They endorse the Dems.
That sentence is just, I don't know. I find it absolutely hilarious.
Of course. It just kind of shows just how empty it's been over the decades and that we haven't had an organized left. Because if it was, then there would be a candidate that they could endorse. And that's why you have the Socialist Party U.S. that has done that, because that's the Eugene Debs party. They would run a candidate and have, more or less, but just not have any ballot lines.
Well, I got to say,
the Greens have ballot lines.
I feel pretty optimistic about the future of the left. Well, in the fact that the left right now in the U.S. is at the strongest that it's been in decades. That, like,
as far as energy, but, like, as far as being an organization that, like,
that's true,
wins elections, let's say, we can get there. It's start, like, with another, like, shot in the arm with the Greens. We've got, I'm just seeing the flood of Howie memes are quadruple what I saw for Jill Stein.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Just as far as online energy, it's better.
Well, I'm working on that.
Yeah.
I'm fully entrenched in the Bernie circle.
Yeah.
And it's right now is just trying to find a place for those Bernie people to go.
Of course. Yeah, right. Because it's not just like them. Like you see this in the centrist side, where centrist side, not that way. But I mean, like, the centrist side, where they consider themselves politically homeless because the Democrats keep going farther left than me. And with Biden and Trump, of course, is everything, and the Republicans keep further right. And with the only two options, I just don't feel like there's a party for me. Now, whenever they do try to start some kind of centrist party, nobody joins it.
Nobody.
It's the same kind of malaise that kind of goes with why don't all these progressives join the Green Party? It just becomes a kind of a bunch of circular arguments going around and around and around. That get really tiring, and I'm always overjoyed when somebody breaks out of them by actually stopping and going, maybe it would be worth trying something different.
I have a lot of I have some more right-winger friends from college, mm-hmm. and a lot of them were saying how they are afraid of that the Democratic Party is going too far left. And I kind of just laughed in their face.
Yeah.
Cause...
To be social Democrats even is like, what times do you think you're living in? Do you think this is normal? Do you think we're not in like, think climate change isn't on our doorstep? Do you think, like, there's more wildfires in California this year, this far, than all of last year? This is because they weren't able to do any controlled burns over the winter. But now, the fires are worse than ever. And it only means the pandemic can only spread worse because you can't shelter in place and evacuate an area at the same time.
Yeah, that's kind of an either-or type deal.
Yeah, this whole, like, you know, you think technocratic fixes and good management from technocrats is going to, like, fix this? What world are you living in? Like, this is what it, like, oh, well, I mean, the argument is that, see, Trump is such a bad technocrat, there is no technocracy, there's no technocratic management happening right now. If there was, the crisis would be fine. There would be no crisis. That's their thinking. It's believable if you kind of know, if you think, if you're in your little privileged bubble about how, like,
right.
like, things are still being delivered to you, your poverty is not like this, this thing that's nibbling at the edges of your life, or you're already in it. So, away from the material circumstances of today, let's look at the past a little bit, through the lens of two writers you definitely know about, probably. So this is from the Greenville Post, which is, their tagline is a good one. Stop whining about a democracy that never was, build a real one. Now this is from a, quote unquote tanky's point of view, Marxist-Leninist. So there will be some paragraphs that we'll skip. I'm just going to focus on what he has to say and the kind of good points he makes about Hitchens and Orwell. And the hollow self-righteousness of anti-communism. And the self-righteousness angle that he comes at kind of comes through with anyone who talks or thinks about woke scolds or cancel culture or these toxic leftists that are they a block? Are they an actual subculture that, you know, is big enough to actually be a problem? It's just like with the class reductionist, in my opinion. But we'll go forward. So this is written by Rainer Shea. In addition to all the propaganda pieces that anti-communists use to legitimize their position, they often utilize a more general rhetorical tool, which is the denunciations of communism that have come from two of the last century's most prominent intellectuals, referring to George Orwell and Christopher Hitchens. These figures maintain large cult followings, or popular followings, and widely seen as moral authorities for their crusades against civilization's evil and hypocritical aspects, which for Orwell was a crusade against totalitarianism, and for Hitchens, a crusade against organized religion. Yet the cultural and ideological makeup of both of these men caused them to infuse their works with an anti-communist agenda, whether they meant to or not. But to give this agenda's followers the sense that they're righteous upholders of honesty and virtue. Eloquent, polemically skilled, and morally self-confident, Orwell and Hitchens were perfectly suited to become cultural idols among politically and literally minded Westerners, particularly of the leftist and anti-establishment kind. Hey, that's us. Their magnetic appeal among this demographic, however, is due to the fact that their messages reinforce the privileged and limited worldview of Western leftists themselves, who have been won over by a liberal ideology which rejects true radicalism. So it becomes a problem when you talk about true radicalism, true communism, because that's kind of the things the left kept splitting on. So when you kind of like, you need someone to follow or something, like there needs to be some kind of example of, which has not been true, the case for our lifetime, unless we're just going to talk about Cuba and DPRK or something, communist states or socialist states, and how, like, there's an example of communism out there to follow. And then it became a constant argument of who is the true upholder of communism? Who's got the right idea? Is it Trotsky or Stalin? Is it Mao or Stalin? Is it Mao or Tito, leader of Yugoslavia? Is it Castro? You know, Castroism. I mean, you get these isms put on people's names because it's like you're putting your political platform is based on what one person in one country that isn't your country is doing, which seems really narrow.
Yeah.
And I haven't had an argument or a conversation with any of these older leftists or these vanguard guys that are still kicking around on why they feel it's so necessary. Well, actually, I think that they do kind of have a way of explaining it, that it's necessary to kind of have a model to follow. Not a pure idealist one pulled out of like with theory, but right. Something that's practical, something that exists today. And, you know, what Castro's doing, that's real. So, Castroism, Maoism. And so when there was a historical event, the Sino-Soviet split, then it became like, is the Soviet Union the upholder of communism, or is China? And then it's like, you have to pick one or the other, but then you have to say which one is doing, you know, because they disagreed and they split, you know?
Right.
And then it keeps going and going then between Mao and Deng, because Mao was trying to hold on to his position, Deng subverted him and brought in the more social democracy kind of, let's do some capitalism. Since, as Marx said, capitalism builds wealth. We're not going to be able to industrialize properly without some capitalism.
Right.
Which is something that Mao rejected. Like, well, that's just going to American businessmen basically kind of pulling away. But, you know, Deng was, but that's something to debate. And when it comes to debates, I want to hear from talking heads. Like us.
Yeah.
I'm not debating people. Quoting Red Basher, who pretended to be on the left was George Orwell. So he's talking about this as like a type. In the middle of World War II, as the Soviet Union was fighting for its life against Nazi invaders at Stalingrad, Orwell announced that a willingness to criticize Russia and Stalin is a test of intellectual honesty. Well, of course you can criticize them, but like, it is the only thing that, from a literary intellectual point of view, is really dangerous. This he wrote for the Monthly Review. This is Parenti quoting. Safely ensconced within the virulently anti-communist society of Britain, Orwell characterized the condemnation of communism as a lonely, courageous act of defiance. Today, his ideological progeny are still at it, offering themselves as intrepid left critics of the left, waging a valiant struggle against imaginary tanky hordes. This kind of happens online, where you have tankies online, but...
Yeah.
They annoy people on Facebook pages. They're not organized. And they're not doing, like... Would you like to read the next part about Animal Farm?
Sure.
By the way, he does declare, of course, that it's great. He's a great writer, and his work should be written. I own one or two of them.
So it was with this conviction of his own moral superiority to the communist left that Orwell would approach the writing of Animal Farm. If one were to interpret Animal Farm as a totally accurate metaphor account of the Russian Revolution, which most of the Western world currently does, the resulting historical knowledge that one gains would be wildly inaccurate.
I want to point out that, like, in high school, you read Animal Farm, right? In English class.
I actually didn't.
Okay. What, did you skip out? You didn't read it? Or
my school
wasn't done.
Didn't do it.
Didn't
I don't know
do
why.
It. Let's see. I think it would be 10th grade English, and you read Animal Farm, and you're told that's an allegory for the Russian Revolution.
Right.
In history class, you don't cover the Russian Revolution. So you're kind of left with that as being your history text. That's bad.
Because
it is primarily a novel. And even if it's like an allegory for, you know, not replacing one tyranny with another, which is important lesson. And it is something that can be leveled against Stalin very much so, in the Soviet Union, but it's to criticize it or just to say this is bad overall and it actually should be destroyed.
Right.
And Churchill's right about like this Iron Curtain that's come down and it's all, the Soviets' fault.
Well, the part where the pig Napoleon, who represents Stalin, drives out Trotsky's stand-in Snowball away from the farm in order to establish Napoleon's own dictatorial control is an absurd distortion of the truth. Trotsky was exiled from Russia when he tried Communist Party, after which he spread lies, supported terrorism and assassination, and collaborated with fascists in order to undermine the USSR.
Now, this is the Stalinist
right,
talking
yeah.
point, by the way. I've yet to, and I guess I need to, like, there's probably a good book that would probably clear this up of what actually happened. Did Trotsky do all these terrible things once he was exiled? Why was he exiled originally? I think it's one or the other.
I remember I did a little bit of
and sour. Research. And is it all sour grapes where Trotsky just spent the rest of his life bashing Stalin because he didn't get his way? Now, there are these little things in, say, Time Goes stuff in a very matter-of-fact way where they discuss how in 1924, like, Russian and World War I's over, and what is the first thing the newly created Poland does? Invade the Soviet Union. So the Red Army pushes them back. But as far as the military facts go, Stalin screwed up his part of the front and allowed the Polish forces to flank the main body that was advancing on Warsaw. And allowed them, basically, the space army pulls out because they run out of resources. They're not going to continue the war. Everyone's sick of war, you know. And between Stalin and Trotsky. So here, let me explain in a short version what the differences between them were. It goes between two permanent revolutions. Which is that, I'll start with Stalin's first since that's the one that prevailed, which is called socialism in one state. So the theory goes, you focus on Russia, Russian security, realpolitik, you know, what's in Russia's or the Soviet Union's interests first, and we build up the Soviet Union, we make it so great, we industrialize, and we make ourselves the model, and then everyone sees how great the third world copies us.
Right.
And we help them do that when appropriate, when possible. Like Cuba. Actually carrying through that, because if you just focus on the Soviet Union and their foreign policy and whatever, there are these instances where supporting some socialists wasn't in their interest, and then they didn't. In fact, right after World War II, because of the state the country was in, there are all these kind of leftist movements in Europe that were just kind of left to get beaten by the right-wing forces after the war, as Britain was totally great. Churchill was like, Iron Curtain, let's, you know, stamp out the other countries. And the only places they couldn't do that was the Bloc. So Trotsky's permanent revolution is kind of the opposite, where we don't really focus on developing Russia so much as to help incite other revolutions in other countries. We kind of need socialism everywhere first. We can't just be an island and then spread out, because capitalism is going to be pushing in.
Right.
Which is what ended up. Who was right in the long run? I think they were both right in various ways. So permanent 5 years of the Russian Soviet Union's history, where they're still just a forming country recovering from a civil war, which is quite terrible, and everyone watched Dr. Zhivago or something, you know, right, for what that kind of looks like. Or, you know, it's ham-fisted, but you see at the end of the movie that you have the general, that his half-brother, and he runs a big dam, and it's like, look what all they built now. But anyway, I digress. In Germany, in Hungary, like right after World War I, communist parties trying to do their own Bolshevik coups.
I think, weren't they fairly successful in Bavaria? I'm trying to remember. There was a...
I mean, there was stuff there. I mean, maybe you're thinking of in World War II, already once the Americans, our forces started closing in and revolted, there was captains who were like, we got to get the SS out of Munich before the Americans get here, or end up Dachau.
A Soviet republic being set up in Germany.
But again, it didn't last, even with, like, yeah, maybe because Soviet support was lacking, they weren't really able to provide it.
Right.
But, meaning doing leaflets, trying to get military forces to change sides, because that's how things worked in Russia. That's how the Bolsheviks did it. So it was really about replicating that. And we can rebuild together, with a larger political bloc, instead of just being the Soviet Union and its sphere of influence, which, just could only shrink over time.
Right.
Or if it ever expanded, American intervention would follow. See Korea, Vietnam.
Gotta love that CIA.
Afghanistan, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, couldn't even go along their borders, right? You know, Afghanistan's on their border. No friendly government for you there. Yeah, so it was okay. So there was like split one between Trotsky and Stalin, and then so the American left kind of had to argue about that. So let's keep going. Animal Farm's villainous caricature of Stalin goes through that. I think we got that point gone. Then it moves on to 1984 and its allegories. You know, Stalin is the big brother, as much as, and he refers to, like, the Soviet Union as the totalitarianism, you know, and how that had to win out, so to speak. But it kind of ignores the creation of corporate dystopias, you know. Now, this is kind of what cyberpunk did, followed, you know, 20 years later, of looking at the other side of it. What kind of dystopias will capitalism create? The kind of totalitarian lack of freedom and so on that we're currently kind of living in.
All hail Lord Bezos.
Yeah, you know what? I have to do another aside because something's bothering me. So I've talked about solarpunk. I've done an episode earlier. It's like episode 30-something. And I've kind of been wanting to do more, but there just aren't a lot of good solarpunk articles now, either because as an artistic movement, I mean, it's still going. Art-wise, it's still good. Story-wise, it's still there. But as far as just conversations, so there's a main solarpunk page. I think maybe 1 out of every 10 posts is something that I would consider to be subversive or what I would consider to be solarpunk, which is, you know, subversive sustainability. That's do it yourself and grassroots and the opposite of what we have now. A true vision of the future. Many of the posts will be about news stories of the day, and worse, it will be what Tesla's doing. Like, there was a post about, like, this guy, such a technophobe. So these tech bros that have basically gone on the solarpunk side, it's like, oh, look, it's an optimistic future. No, this is, we're trying to be not technocrats here. We're trying right. to, like, we're not saying the good future is actually less technology or a more appropriate use of it. Not just building big ass factories and putting solar panels on things and saying that's what sustainability looks like. That's what this guy did. It was like a new Tesla plant in Germany or something that took a long legal battle to actually build, or it's still actually in concept. And he kind of misses the fact that it's taking a big chunk of forest out, on. And that's a big ass building. And like, there's people kind of trying to explain how this is dumb and how, like, you know, the big corporation stomping out like local desires for conservation is kind of not what solarpunk is. And he's just like, you guys are all crazy, you know, hippies or something. Like, you're on the wrong page, man. But it's most of the posts there are now like this stuff. It's like, it's either environmental news. It's not really what the page is for. It sucks. But then there's also, solarpunk anarchist, which then is kind of what it should be. So you go there. Go to Solarpunk Anarchist, not the regular Solarpunk site.
I'll go check them out now.
Mm-hmm. Especially when there's actually more posts of, like, art, architecture, and art and stuff that does make you think, like, this is completely different than what we have. And this is organic and sustainable. It's made of nature. It's working with nature or something like that. It's passive, you know. So there's this really cool building that's, like, made of grown trees and stuff. There's some really good stuff. One post was about hand painted mud houses of Burkina Faso, which is West Africa, part of it anyway. And then he moves on about Hitchens. It's the same thing, so I'm going to skip ahead to the end, or a little bit lower down. As Orwell and Hitchens exaggerate the exaggerated horrors of so-called totalitarian communist governments like the Soviet Union and North Korea, they contributed to a far more real form of oppression that they didn't seem to care much about, which is the power structure of capitalism and empire. This horror is just as ghastly as the eternally domineering totalitarianism that they believed had taken hold in communist countries. Now, that's kind of an assertion, but let's just say, for the sake of the benefit of the doubt, that it isn't as bad as others say, like these guys. The surveillance in the U.S. empire on its own people has become total. Its propaganda is so powerful that it can turn democratically elected leaders into dictators, create WMDs out of thin air. Since World War II, it's regularly razed nations to the ground in a series of war campaigns that have killed around 30 million people. The global corporations that operate it have the ability to financially strangle entire nations and kill disfavored leaders, as it's attempted to do other places. The figures at the top of it are an oligarchical cabal of billionaires who hold more wealth than the majority of humanity combined does. Global capitalism is Big Brother. We're facing a worldwide corporate totalitarian dictatorship, and it may take a more oppressive form than ever after the planet comes to feel the full brunt of the climate crisis. North Korea, China, and other ideological heirs to the Soviet Union that Orwell and Hitchens demonize are the strongholds of a resistance against this, even as the Western left largely continues to treat them like enemies. It's time for us to recognize the hollowness of these figures' self-righteousness, disavowal of the existing socialist states. Let me go back a little bit. There was another point that I wanted to. So he talks of a quote about from Hitchens about North Korea, where it's like it's like a caricature. What strikes me about this quote about North Korea and how it's intriguing analogies, and this is Hitchens who was giving it, his eloquent wording, much like Orwell's dark paragraphs about the Soviet Union from the climax of 1984, presents a colossal lie in a way that's intellectually compelling for someone who hasn't been accurately informed about the subject's matter. It would have gotten in the way of Hitchens' rhetorical flow to acknowledge that the DPRK, North Korea, is not that total, but rather that, you know, say its leaders, like the Kim Jong-un, is a diplomatic figurehead only. That's why he just does diplomatic visits and stuff. Locally, they actually do have, like, elected leaders and stuff. But, like Cuba. I've described in detail about how Cuba has local elections, and they're nonpartisan because it's one party, but it's one form that nonpartisan elections take. That you have a party that guides the state, and everyone else on the local level solving everyday problems is just doing it like any Democrat in Albany is just doing it under that name.
Don't they have, aren't the people represented in their version of Congress?
Yes.
Aren't the people...
And it's more diverse than ours.
But aren't the people represented via their workplace and through their...
There's that too.
...their type of job instead of just their political ideology, which I think is really interesting. And I kind of like the idea of work, like being represented through your workplace. I don't know. It's
a serious what if in American history was if the New Deal kept going in the social democrat or democratic socialist direction. I think the next step, along with the, you know, economic bill of rights that FDR was talking about, was something called like the Union Representation Act, that the CIO and other big unions would actually get seats in Congress.
I like that.
Yeah. Which would also kind of, like the Senate, stabilize politics into a pro-labor centric, or at least labor would be there. They wouldn't have to buy Democrats. They would be there.
The Senate is, frankly, probably one of the most undemocratic systems that we have at the moment.
It was created to ensure that American government wasn't too populist, which is... You know, a lot of moderates will say that's a great thing. And that's why they'll you know, balk at any kind of change, even in the Electoral College. And that's why, I guess, Buttigieg, to your friend, was somewhat favorable of some kind of progressive.
Buttigieg was a liberal who kind of adopted some progressive ideas to posture as a progressive.
So let me finish. With this, and then we can move on with further jibber jabber. Okay, it was this flaw in Hitchens' thinking. In the same vein that Orwell and the other left anti-communists, Hitchens acted as a figure of controlled opposition within Western left, because basically most of their role was bashing socialists, as they also bashed, say, as Hitchens did, organized religion, to say that, well, the only thing worse than organized religion are communist states.
Ugh.
It was this flaw in Hitchens' thinking that set him on the infamous Trotz-turned-neocons path. A few years after denouncing Clinton's horrific bombing of Yugoslavia, Hitchens endorsed the invasion of Iraq. He reacted to 9/11 by announcing that he was no longer on the left. Sound familiar? Anyone who says, like, I've left the left because they're just too toxic now. They're crazy. They're irrational. Having principles and following them. Let's see, he swore a sort of oath to remain coldly furious until fascism with an Islamic face was brought to a most strict and merciless account, quoting him. After detailing the war crimes of Henry Kissinger, Hitchens embraced Iraq war architect Paul Wolfowitz, his protege, as a friend and took out his American citizenship in 2007 ceremony presided over by Bush's head of Homeland Security, showing that his hatred for hypocrites and perpetrators of atrocities no longer applied. Like the other Trotskyites, which is a pejorative, so I'll change it to Trotskyists.
Yeah.
Who followed this trend of coming to support imperialism, Hitchens went through an ideological development comparable to that of 1984's Winston Smith, who came to adopt the party's ideology after forming detesting it. But what won him over wasn't coercion and terror like the case with Smith, a fictional character, by the way, but the seductive nature of the Empire's worldview of national exceptionalism, righteous global war against nefarious enemies. Neocons are effectively Trotskyism in that way, as there are a lot of Trotskyists who turned into neocons over the many decades, especially with the fall of the Soviet Union, which then was like the ultimate argument in their cap, the feather in their cap, to say, like, see, Stalin's way of socialism one country doesn't work. We have to work in the system we have, or something like that. That's what they turned around with. Now, there are a lot of Trotskyists I like and work with and or identify as such who are, say, in the Green Party or whatever, or they're actually doing labor organizing. They just don't talk about it in that kind of line-drawing, Life of Brian skit kind of way.
Right.
Unless the splitting is then happening between independent left and democratic shills. That's kind of what occurs at the left convention. So, let's see, before the show, you're talking about the, you had right wingers attacking Cuba.
Yeah, I'm in a Rick and Morty Facebook group.
Ah, called for the smart people.
Yeah, to be fair, you have to have a very high IQ
to watch understand Rick and Morty. Yeah.
Well, so Rick and Morty is a very interesting show in that I think it generally attracts extremists from all sides of the spectrum. So, like, there's a lot of, like, good, woke, left Rick and Morty fans that I would...
Just, are you nihilist? You know, then it attracts you.
And but like there's that. Also... a lot of racist Rick and Morty fans. And
why wouldn't there be?
This one group that is for Rick and Morty has become kind of an ideological battleground, and it's mainly been around, like, Black Lives Matter.
Are you saying that a cartoon was politicized? Stop getting your politics out of here. It's only something I actually put in one of my montages.
Jeez. Well, I like to kind of poke the bear a little bit and participate in the fight. And one guy, he posted a video by Turning Point University. Their
TP belongs in the toilet.
Exactly. They posted a video that was done by TP. And it was about, like, a bunch of dude bro chads who all went to Cuba and was saying how Cuba is a shithole and there's no
food. Watch the language.
Right, sorry. There's no food and there's...
Lines at Chops. Chops are very limited in what they sell. Well, the state, there's the state shops and then there's, I guess, other shops. But
well, they were showing footage of how everything's terrible. And I commented on the video and I was like, hey, isn't Cuba a tourist destination? Like, I don't trust this video, because if what you are presenting is true, then how would they support their tourist industry? And that right winger did not have a good answer and backed down and basically immediately went, oh, I don't agree entirely with what they say. I just thought it was interesting and wanted to share it. And I'm like, okay, well, I don't believe it. And that was kind of the end of that.
Just say no. Just say, why should I believe this? You know,
exactly.
Where's your facts and logic, man?
Like, it's really funny when a lot of times when a right-winger presents what they believe to be airtight, perfect, clear, now this'll show those idiot leftists.
Or at least back up, like, their worldview and stuff.
If you, like, just look at them square in the eye and say, hey, I don't believe you. They don't have, they generally don't have good evidence to back up their claims. Like, they don't have anything to back up what they're saying.
It also depends on how you're coming at an issue. So, like, how do you view success? Our differences of worldviews, values, particularly, change how we judge things. And this is kind of what causes the splits or the disagreements.
Right.
Of like, do you value the kind of decentralization that Trotsky advocated for? Or do you think that even suggesting that in the Communist Party was subversive and that's why he had to go? Which is the Stalinist position. That just saying that unions should just have more of a say or their own, or the Soviets themselves need to be like the Congress instead of however it was, the party.
Right.
Party people. Who are then kind of functionaries of a sort. Then there's how we would view it, like leftists organize trips to Cuba as a group, and they arrange for to meet union people and or go into this, like they create a tourist trip that isn't just going to shop in the beach
right.
and do consumptive things, but to actually like visit, talk to Cubans and meet people, which is, you know, is a good goal to go when you're traveling. To learn about stuff.
I've heard that like the Cuban economy is actually like about one third worker owned. I don't have.
Yeah, that's about it. And then there's a bunch, and then the other third is like unionized, and now there's like kind of small business owners.
But like that's
which was the reform in the 90s, or it's been a reform over the last 15 years.
Like, that's honestly incredible. Like I wish our economy could have. More worker ownership
yeah.
and more having the people.
And people get back. People get it backwards. Production. People get it backwards that like if we had the same ratio, then like America would be like Cuba. But it's like, well, Cuba is also an island that's still under blockade.
Right.
We're not. And so a America that's one third co-ops or worker owned is not going to be as poor or whatever state you think Cuba's in. It certainly grows all of its own food sustainably, and because it had to, something that we'll have to do once the oil stops flowing. But at the moment, oh God, there was this one story about how, because of the pandemic, you know, the oil is not being used fast enough. You know, we actually, if we ever reduce consumption, but the production can't stop, now like there's all these oil tankers just floating around the ocean with nowhere to go.
Like I saw it
because there's nowhere to unload.
For a couple days, oil went negative. Like,
yes, yeah. So that was a few months ago, but there was at the same time there was also just like the oil is being stored on the tankers,
right?
Just floating around, going from trying to find a port to float it, but there is none because it's all just being stored because we weren't using it enough. And it's just like, can we just stop the spigot a little bit? And then, but that would create basically higher prices or less supply, and so demand would need to, you know, be forecut. Just like in the oil crunch. Okay, moving on to our next to our break, and then we'll go to the next hour.
All right.
Welcome back to the second half of the Three Left Show this Saturday. So this this episode is called Left Wing Culture War because we're discussing kind of splits and disagreements in the left in the past in order to kind of maybe take some lessons or to just kind of digest it as we move forward with the project ahead of us. What is our project? Well, that's something to discuss and debate. I wish we kind of... Well, we do debate it, but mostly what occurs, at least in the wider scale of the national conversation, is still image stuff of arguing about how we talk about things, not what we're actually doing. This is kind of annoying and disheartening. Or rather, it makes me sweat because it's like, we can't do this for another 4 years. We just can't argue. I mean, I can argue with like, you know, comfortable middle class people that I know about whether or not like it's worth for them to vote for the Green Party this election instead of Biden, which would be really wasting their vote. Biden's going to win New York, guys. I don't know how you think Trump is going to get more votes or something, but we got Electoral College, and this seems to wipe their mind. They still think, like, popular vote matters. Biden needs all the votes he can get, or something like that. It's like, yeah, it's a pick your battles, but also pick your project. And a project is kind of a shorthand for the thing you work on your entire life, or for the next decade. And it needs to be something that takes a decade. An election or voting for Biden is definitely, or the Democrat, is not a project. Getting other people to vote for a Democrat, unless you're actually actively campaigning for them, is also not a project. It's consumerism. Because you're buying a sign or this or that, you know. I bought a Hawken shirt. It goes eco-socialism. Got a new shirt. Some to act. Pleasure-seeking and stuff. But I'm going to wear it all the time. And whatnot. And yeah, so I just want to get that out of the way, bothering me. So I have a piece from, which is also kind of an argument that would happen in her left, and it represents other types of arguments or subcultures. Also, a side that I want to get your thoughts on is that the only way that we're able to be able to organize ourselves now is not really based on workplace, since workplaces are a rare thing. Is by subculture.
Right.
Now, sometimes a workplace is a type of subculture, but no one stays in a workplace long enough, no one doing a job long enough. Unless you have maybe gig workers are a type of subculture that can be, you know, unionized, organized. But otherwise, I see subcultures online. That's how we identify ourselves. It's like, or at least our actual identities, whether they be based on consumption, like, you know, being a nerd, seeing these kind of movies, this kind of TV, or music, especially music. But that can also be a self-creative act. It doesn't have to be something you buy. Just like anything else. Subcultures that are actually, you can kind of classify them as the consumptive subcultures, the creative kind, creative ones. Those are the ones that maybe we could focus on or consider, like, we need to be part of these things. Actual artist subcultures and stuff like that. Like solar punk to me, a creative subculture. Or like how the left is a creative subculture, memeing, you know, creating memes, yeah. Making memes is a project. While right wingers are just copying, like what's their project? What is their subculture even? Like it's dead.
Well, they're.
Or culture. It's drinking. It's drinking, you know, yeah. drinking subculture isn't a subculture because it's really just, it's addiction put into a cultural lens or something. That involves darts and karaoke, maybe. Not bashing karaoke. So here's one from Morningstar, which I think is in UK, but you can insert America and we can do that in our own fashion. The question of there is no contradiction between patriotism and socialism. So this goes in the questions that come across my mind when it comes to debate / conversations that I actually do have with regular Joes about statue removal, choosing statues, or like, you know, discussions of destroying history, or arguments for the changing statues and pulling down statues is the same as pulling down the whole country. And this is at least how the right is painting us as. And then we could respond with, hell yeah, we want to destroy America. It's based on slavery and racism, and our Constitution needs to be completely overhauled.
Right, but we don't want to show our power level in order to co-opt a phrase from the right.
We also don't want to feed their framing of things, because exactly. That's what the liberal/left has done over the neoliberal era. Always accepted their framing of things ever since Carter. Ever since 72, really. But so then. That also goes for the framing of patriotism. So, like, there are these concepts that everyone identifies with, people going along to get along, and we don't really want to turn them off. We want to be able to relate, be in solidarity with them, not just look down and feel smug and smart like Rick and Morty fans, but, like, the things they watch, which is reality TV, I guess. Pawn Stars.
Yeah.
You know, we can insert socialist theory in the Pawn Stars. It just comes in the meme of like, capitalism says, like you say, well, I need $1,000 for this, and capitalism says, best I can do is 800.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of good left-wing cooperatization of The Sopranos. I think the page is called Sassy Socialist
Sopranos Memes. I have seen that. I don't know how much legs that has.
I don't know either.
How are you feeling?
I appreciate it. I like any time the left co-ops some kind of pop culture and takes it for themselves.
And we can kind of do that with American history. It just includes like not seeing, and it is kind of reductionist of a sort, to simply say American history is one of slavery and oppression racism. So, because there's all this other history that has been either erased or subdued or buried and needs to be redug up, rewritten about, or just propagated in the Howards End fashion.
Well, so, I've actually seen tankies have co-opted Legally Blonde. Like, apparently, the
blonde in there.
Like, there's, I'm trying to remember the page, but, there's one that it's just dedicated to, the character from Legally Blonde, except for having her be, like, a full on communist. And it's,
you can kind of do that with anything.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what's funny about it as a joke, just to say, like, to take things like Sonic or other things and just make them say communist things.
Right.
Which is funny, but also like, where is this really going? Like, can this be more than a joke? I mean, I don't think this is cultural, adoption or something like that. I think it's just cannibalizing it. Let's hear some arguments for, we need to articulate socialist patriotism. And this also dovetails with Orwell. He actually mentions him. So actually, this will dovetail nicely. A genuine love of our country and its people, in opposition to the militarism and imperialism, writes Matt Widowson. Rebecca Long Bailey's call to revive this progressive patriotism, published in The Garden at the end of 2019, appeared to be greeted with horror by left Twitter. While Long Bailey's article did not expand further on what she meant by progressive patriotism, like so many articles do, or what policies would be guided by the slogan, it appeared to be the very word patriotism what was shocking. Social media was awash with a mixture of liberal disdain, mainly from those with EU flags in their Twitter handles. Apparently not all flag waving is bad. And the typical ultra-leftist complaints about socialism in one country. The truth is that patriotism can be compatible with socialism and internationalism. The fact that we're all in this together as a world. In fact, in the current age of nation-states, it is necessary to achieving it. To utterly dismiss every form of patriotism is to dismiss the entire history of national liberation, which struggled, and in some cases still do, to overthrow colonial rule by powers such as Britain. So this goes to nationalist struggles like in Cuba and Africa, where their struggle, their ability to self-govern, is based around creating a nation-state. So to say, like, no nation states, or nation states is, you know, being patriotic, Angolan or Kenyan is just not the best way of being a lefty. That's not entirely true, especially in the third world. But this is where it becomes like a third world patriotism versus a first world.
Right.
Like, so should we be patriotic Americans as we are at the top of the pyramid looking down on everyone? Because that's where the supremacy comes in.
Exactly.
Outright dismissal of patriotism also stems from a lack of class analysis, which fails to discern the difference between nationalism of a ruling class and the hidden history and aspirations of workers. Perhaps some of Long Bailey's social media critics dismiss patriotism due to a commitment instead to international socialism. As much as the ideal of a global socialism is desirable and eventually a necessity, we still live in an age when the nation state remains the only realistic vehicle for the first steps toward socialism. There is no other existing political community capable of delivering the transformation required to bring about any kind of leftism. There is no better means of defending it. Now, this point right here, this paragraph, I have reservations about it because it's exactly the same thing said about the Democratic Party.
Oh.
Just insert a nation state with Democratic Party. Are the only game in town. They're the only realistic vehicle to use to win office. These are the things said by DSA and Jacobin and whatever. Don't build your own thing. Can never build your own thing. Even though community groups do it every goddamn day. And while some may look to international forums such as the UN to reform or defend certain rights, the fact is, and they are very bad at that, the fact that the specific struggle for socialism and democracy only happens within the framework of a state. It remains the only game in town. It's Tina defense. There's no alternative. And I want to avoid that as much as possible. And so this is where I disagree with this guy kind of stops. But I just want to point out my unease of that. Because it contradicts what I'm doing and what I believe. Anyway. Perhaps there is also fear among the opponents of progressive patriotism about ceding ground to the reactionary kind. This is perhaps understandable, as there has been, it's kind of what happens, has been a noticeable and troubling shift towards the hard right around the world. But again, this misses the difference between the official nationalism promoted by ruling class and the potential for a socialist, and by the way, both sides of the ruling class, both the finance and the factory owners, whatever form they take now. You know, the owner of Goya, Hobby Lobby, Home Depot, all of the CEOs that support and give to Trump.
Right.
Because it's in their interest to divide people on identity and stuff. Finance doesn't care to do that. They don't need to. They control all the money, so and they don't right. really need to worry about that. So they can say, you know, wave gay flags and say, yeah, you know,
rainbow capitalism.
Yes. So, but anyway, but both of them are pro-war and pro-empire and say, well, we got to defend ourselves from the terrorists, right? You know, we got to, you know, the socialist states are dictatorships. And thus, all of Congress rises when Guaido comes to Congress and applaud a standing ovation when Trump says that socialism will never come to America. Yes, I didn't do his voice. I don't care to. Perhaps it's because we are all most familiar with the official nationalisms of the ruling class. This is either the one of the right, the story of great Americans, great battles and achievements of our great nation, or the softer, liberal, more business-friendly, cool America style cultivated during the last our lifetimes. Both of these nationalism, you know, that we spread democracy in the world, and we're still its bastion and purveyor of human rights. No one else can defend human rights like we can.
No, we got the monopoly on.
But this guy's writing from the UK. Both of these nationalisms draw on a nostalgia for a so-called golden age, whether it be a fantasy version of the 50s or the simulation of the 60s. Both of these nationalisms tend to overlook the horrors of our empire, with the right-wing version celebrating Britain's, in this case, Britain's past version, attempting to sanitize the symbols of empire. Spice Girl wearing a butcher's apron miniskirt. Nationalist sentiment relies on stories and symbols, and progressive vision needs to rely on a people's counter-narrative to the official story. This would be the radical history of our country. It is the story of unionization, the labor movement, the segregationist movement, the Underground Railroad, and of course the Civil Rights Movement. And it would then be, to more contemporarily, talking about environmental movement, the blocking of pipelines and nuclear power plants, battle in Seattle. It is an inclusive national history, as the struggles of minority groups intertwine and become an important part of the story of a radical America. Our bus boycotts, our battles with fascists, in the streets, as Jewish history has, in New York. Yeah. It is also an internationalist history, which includes a plethora of solidarity movements and a strong tradition of peace activism. Now, in America, I'm not sure if that's really the case, because our movements have always kind of been laced with a kind of racism, with America's, intertwined with America's racism. Yeah. So this is where, like, America's racist country is completely true, because even our union movements were still segregated.
Yeah.
And doing the quote-unquote class reductionist thing of, we're going to unionize ourselves based on workplace, and if all the black people are over on this workplace, then we'll organize them separately. We won't have them in the same union. And then you had unions that are like, we're not going to federate with them. They drive our wages down, because we would have to negotiate a wage that would be, I guess, the same across state lines, which was why you kind of needed mob bosses and union leaders, because they were able to kind of pull things together in a coercive way. At least that's the story of Hoffa that I seem to be related via the movie, The Irishman, which I did not watch. I don't really care to.
I haven't seen it either.
With a left-wing government in power, it's what some summary was. With a left-wing government in power, an alternative patriotism. Now, of course, see, it's kind of car before the horse. Once we get a left-wing government, then we can form our own narrative about American history.
Right.
But it's also kind of, we do our own form of American history, and that way we can get more liberals on our side, because we're not, quote-unquote, burning everything down, and we're still doing positive things. We're not just destroying. We are, in fact, creating. The real contradictions come in where, like, so the slave trader statue that was from in Bristol that was torn down was replaced by the people, mind you, an artist and one of the, and the activists who posed on it with her fist in the air.
Yeah, I saw that.
And so an artist made a sculpture of her, made out of resin, really cool, very lifelike. You know, it was just a statue of her, life size, and they put it on the pedestal. But they did it without permission. So the city is removing it. And it's funny, funny in the most, in a horrific way.
Yeah.
That you have, okay, a riot or a mob tore down the statue, right? Will of the people, quote unquote.
Right.
The city then says, the people will decide what new statue will go in. And since you guys didn't get proper permission, we're going to remove this. But we're going to let the people decide what should go there. As if the people's consent is what, you know, people's consent is what took the statue down. Shouldn't it be the people's consent that if an artist puts something there and everyone's cool with it and nobody tears that down?
Yeah.
But no, it has to be official. It has to be through. They have to recoup some side kind of control. It's so sad.
Yeah.
But it just hurts the brain. It hurts the mind thinking about, like, do you not realize how what they look like? You know, and again, that's how they act. Now, we're taking a statue down in Albany for official channels because a lot of people complained to the mayor directly, I guess, about Philip Schuyler, Revolutionary War general, and thus had a few slaves under his belt.
Right.
And his holdings, because among many of the figures of the time who were remembered and have statues or monuments, they were the rich people. And the Schuyler Mansion is still one of the colonial houses left in Albany. It's a museum. So even without the statue in front of City Hall, there's still Schuyler Mansion, and the statue could just move there, which is what will happen. Then the debate becomes, what do you replace it with? I have an idea. Albany County, its article history, has rent strike in the 1840s, and I think we should have a rent striker as the statue there.
I like that.
I put out the idea of fundraising for it, you know, because this is how these statues are usually paid for. They're fundraised, and they're not city bought, you know. It's just city permission to put them somewhere.
I gotta say, instead of statues, I'm a huge fan of having ceremonial communal guillotines put up.
Or anything like maypoles, or something festive that changes throughout the year. Shows the changing of time and our connection with nature.
Right.
Something like that. But a rent striker in their calico dress and with a tin horn and a rifle, I think would be pretty sweet.
I think that's a pretty good idea.
So let's see. Last bit of this. Patriotism then becomes a commitment to a national project. There's that word again. A patriotism which is inclusive, as it would not be dependent on the ethnicity or the country of one's birth, because the narrative is now switched to just labor and making stuff and doing stuff. It doesn't matter what language, ethnicity, or whatever that you are. The project of the country of Britain is really just based on the geography, or America, right? And thus, that geography could even change. We could call it different things.
Right.
Like not America anymore. You should always call it United States. Because America is just a made-up concept to put on the continent, which is lies. This is stolen land, so on. And that would be part of the narrative, too. But it's also not just the negative of the genocide, but also the resistance to it. The fact that these First Nations have a culture, subcultures, and are quite vibrant and can be more vibrant and evolving over time. They're not just these static museum pieces, which is what makes me uncomfortable about them, but they can also change if given room to. Not just put in this little box and piece of land. If the left is to succeed, then we need to start talking about concepts such as patriotism, nationalism, without simply reaffirming the inflexible dogma or resorting to hysteria, meaning the Trotskyist line, actually, that socialism has to be international, forget national borders, they're really quite meaningless. Government is really just based on where you are. In a world where the nation state remains a reality, though it really shouldn't be, or its days are numbered, and the only realistic, and this is where this frame of mind about it's the only game in town is like, well, but how much longer? And, like, it's also a matter of, like, how long do you project that it's going to be the only game in town? How much longer? Like, is how much longer is this crisis going to go? Is it still going to be the only game in town when the decade's out? Or in 2 decades? I mean, certainly it seemed like the imperial empires of, you know, Britain, France, and so on were still kicking after the Second World War, but their days were numbered. Another 20 years and decolonization was almost done. Yeah. And then it just became really pathetic when any British politician talked about trying to retain the empire and the glory of it and so on. But then Thatcher kind of put a new, and Reagan, that term put a new spin on
neoliberalism.
Yes, exactly. The new spin on our empires to kind of give them another burst of energy. So we kind of need to head that off and oppose it, which it seemed like a lot of people were just resigned to it because it was just so popular at the time and just like, well, we can't go against this. We're going to be, it'll be the McCarthy era all over again, which had just finished basically, or it was in some minds still going on that you're going to get fired. You're going to get canceled if you're openly hostile to this narrative that America is the shining city on the hill and we can do no wrong. And Vietnam wasn't a mistake.
Yeah, I actually, at my Thanksgiving, I had my uncle storm out of Thanksgiving dinner because...
You caused a family member rage quit?
Yeah, I caused my uncle to rage quit because I said that the U.S. wasn't the greatest country in the world.
That's all you had to say.
That's all I had to say.
Not the greatest.
Yeah, I said that, we're not... I don't believe that we are the greatest country in the world. And then he went on a tirade. And it was...
You basically told him that... was he a vet?
No. No, he's
interesting.
Just a...
Because usually if it's vets, there's usually trauma involved to say, like, their friends died for nothing or something like that. That's pretty... it's insulting for a real reason.
Yeah.
It's a physical trauma that, you know, that they would be triggered. But what do you think triggered your uncle?
Well, I told him that I wasn't going to blindly worship the flag and that I would prefer to be critical of our country.
Yeah. And very, actually, very, very gentle pushback.
Yeah. And I said that I think we have to acknowledge all of the things that our country has done wrong. And,
but we haven't done anything wrong.
Exactly.
Nothing, nothing wrong. Slavery, completely, you know, not a mistake.
Right.
I mean, what else could we have done? It wasn't immoral.
Yeah. It was just, it was funny. I still laugh at how I got him to just do the full-on rage quit.
Mm-hmm. Because he had to take a step out and take a breath or else he was going to do something really regretful.
Exactly.
Yeah. What was his tirade? What did it sound like? What kind of things, like, what issues was he, like, jumping around to?
Stream of consciousness. We're a Jewish family, so he was jumping around to the fact that we have religious freedom and saying how in Canada, on your tax forms, you have to put down your religion, and that's putting you on a list. That Canada puts you on a list with your religion, and they're going to come, they could come for you there, that here we have freedom, and we have our freedoms that they'll never come for us here.
So the feds don't have the ability to get the rolls of temples.
Right.
They just, what, like?
I don't know what he was saying how...
I think he's thinking in terms of, like, the only way a government can have a list is, like, back in the standards of 1900 or something. Like, you have to give them the information. You know, we're surrounded by computerized information about ourselves, right?
It's the same.
And they have access to it.
Idiotic notion of, oh, they'll never chip me. Well, even if you
your
don't...
Your phone has a chip.
Exactly.
They don't need, that's redundant.
You willingly carry around a cell phone yes. that tracks your location at all times. And they don't need to chip you. They already have everything.
The chip is for your boss. Like, if it's a under-the-skin like chip for access instead of a ID card. But, yeah. But if it is in the same diagram, then it is a matter of total control of work and government, you know, business and private and public, which, you know, is more complete, you know. But they're not thinking like that.
No.
They're just like, it's all the same. It's all government, blah, blah, blah. So let's move on to the last piece right. we got. But obviously we'll dovetail other things. So this one's going to be a fun little parable. So it's almost like, not a play, of course. It's not written like that. But in the same vein of going back to the splits in the left, going even further back than World War I, because before that, the Russian Revolution was the third international. So that means there was two others before that. And each international was like its own organization of leftists that disagreed about stuff and then have split. And that's why there needed to be a second one. So, like, the first one was split between, like, standard trade unionism and, quote-unquote, communism, right? Actually trying to change the form of government. Then the second one was that kind of state socialism versus anarchism. And that's kind of what developed and then was kind of, quote-unquote, settled by the Russian Revolution. Or at least it created a battle line that was an actual concrete thing that was no longer kind of an abstract disagreement, but something that like actually had a material like, look, you need to take a side here.
Right.
Are you for the Soviet Union what they're doing or not? Are they like the thing we want to replicate or not? And for those that didn't want to, it kind of put them like outside of left-wing organizing.
Yeah.
Then again, another split 20 years later of like, fascism's on the rise. Do we side with the Soviet Union or you know? You know, or do you do the United Front and work with Social Democrats or the Democratic Party? Or do we keep doing our own thing and see if we can like fight them on our own or something like that? And then you have arguments about the history of being the fascists, like fascist movements in America or UK, about how it took working with the government.
Right.
Which I can cover in the next episode that we do, the left-wing culture war. So we'll go back to that, actually. Mm-hmm. That'll be a good topic to go back to. So this one is a meeting between Lenin and Kropotkin. So Kropotkin is a major anarchist writer. Bakunin wrote the bread book, or did Kropotkin?
Kropotkin wrote the bread book.
Okay. And you're reading that in a reading group right now.
I have a Discord server, and someone was like, hey, we should do a book club. And I said, that is a fantastic idea. So every about 3 or 4 days, I found from Audible Anarchist, they have all of the different chapters of The Conquest of Bread.
Mm-hmm.
And each chapter is about 20 to 40 minutes. So I've been posting each chapter.
Very digestible. Yeah, they are short chapters. It's not a long book. Yeah. You can read it in a day. If you put your mind to it.
I listened to the full thing, and it's about 6 hours.
Yeah.
I'll post a chapter, and then I'll write a quick blurb talking about my feelings and my opinions.
In a later episode, we'll just discuss once you're done with it, and we'll discuss. Because I haven't read all of it, or if I did, it was a while ago. Because I can summarize it right now as, like, the meaning of the title is that, like, if you're going to do social change, you kind of need farmers on your side, and you kind of need a bridge or organization that includes both urban and rural workers, which is something that, like I talked about this, where like any kind of political change, big political change in the 20th century was led by industrial workers, meaning urban ones,
right?
Not farmers. When farmers would rise up and do some kind of, strike, let's say, they ended up kind of losing or having the cave or they're crushed because they didn't have the people in the cities on their side.
Exactly.
Or they didn't want to.
What's the
and which is the kind of which is where the self-defeating of the blue collar worker in the country who loves Trump or at least is tolerated or just hates liberal elites, you know, sees them as the enemy, which they are, as far as finance capital is concerned, they are the enemy.
Yeah.
But it's Hobby Lobby and Home Depot that you go to the shop So you see them as like the necessary, like, people you depend on. Corporate America part anyway.
Right.
So I can see why they would pick one over the other, and how to discuss, like, how to change their mind about, like, you're on the wrong side, or, like, here's a different side you could be on that is neither the latte-sipping limousine liberals.
Right.
Or these CEOs that, you know, overcharge you for a hammer, or fertilizer, or prevent you from fixing your tractor and buying your own parts, right to repair and such. So anyway, a divide between, so yes, I mentioned one major split between anarchists and a lot of the other left occurred when the Russian Revolution, quote unquote, succeeded.
Right.
And so this is a kind of from the memoir of one of Lenin's assistants. So this is one of the, like, ministers in government. In May 1919, Lenin met Kropotkin in the Kremlin. Lenin admired him, especially for his book, The Great French Revolution. But the conversation revealed how the anarchist leader was more interested in this or that cooperative being set up and had lost the general picture of where the revolution was going. I found this especially interesting and poignant these days because a lot of, like, your non-revolutionary left is obsessed with talking about co-ops. Co-op economy this. Now, of course, I put it in my intro too, so
right.
I'm not purist about this. But I just want to point it out. Okay, so the conversation revealed... Okay, after the February Revolution, February 1, that's the one where the Tsar is overthrown and then a liberal government is set up, but they didn't end the war, which is kind of why everyone was still really hated them.
Right.
So it wasn't really that big of an... I don't see it as a big injustice that the Bolsheviks then did their own coup, because, like, well, if they ended the war and made the peace settlement and made, you know, market reforms to feed everyone, then they wouldn't, like, they screwed up. Okay? Anyway. It was a failure of democracy, but, you know, it failed. They only had half a year. After the February Revolution in June 12, 1917, Kropotkin returned to Russia from England, to Petrograd, where he wanted to live. Soon, however, he changed his mind and moved to Moscow. One day, it was the year 1918, a relative of Petror Alexandrovich Kropotkin, that's his full name, his daughter, if I remember correctly, together, and by the way, this is the guy speaking here, the guy from the past. This is an article written by someone else today. His daughter and I remember correctly, together with her husband, applied at my office at the Committee of the Soviet of People's Commissars, also known as the Strakokom, and she told me that the problems he had to endure in his search for a residence. It was clear that this was the result of a gigantic misunderstanding, since Kropotkin was a veteran of the revolution, obviously had the right to a residence. Also during the stormy revolutionary period, where everything's chaotic, put together, and the middle of the Civil War. So I got in touch with Kropotkin again, whom I knew from the past. I immediately notified Vladimir Yiddish, and he at once ordered me to issue a residence permit in the name of Petrar Alexandrovich, which I acted upon immediately. Shortly thereafter, I paid him a visit to find out how he was doing, and our encounter was extraordinarily cheerful and cordial. He was living very modestly in his room, where many books and everything in sight indicated that he was arduously busy with literary work. Immediately after our reunion, he mentioned his attitude to the October one. The Bolshevik Revolution had surprised him at an already advanced age, the fact that they were able to do the coup. And this was all, like, Trotsky was the headliner of that, the underliner, and that's where, like, his fan club formed, because he's the one who organized that. Stalin was the bit player then. The dark horse, as it were. When I objected that the whole underground part of our party that had revolutionary experience was already... Oh, yeah, but I have to double back then, because, see, Stalin's work was in the criminal underworld, basically getting the funding for it. Stealing. Like a supervillain. You know, to do anything on your own, you kind of have to rob a bank. And that's what Stalin did. So anyway, he paid for the guns. And then, yeah. That is the case in Russia. Let's see. When I objected that the whole underground part of our... it was his opinion only people under 40 could actively participate in the revolution, the movement. When I objected that the whole underground part of our party that had its experience was already above that age, he replied, "That is the case in Russia, indeed. We have here outstanding revolutionaries of 50 years or older. But as far as my age is concerned, that is another matter. The events of our complicated life at that time, however, were keeping him very busy, and when the whites and the Soviet enemies surrounded Soviet Russia, he sympathized completely with the fate of our movement. He once told me, would you like to read this?
He once told me, during all the activities of the present revolutionary political parties, we must never forget that the October movement of the proletariat...
Oh, yeah, and feel free to drop the extra words that don't really need to be put in there, like replace proletariat with worker.
Okay.
You know, make it easier on
which
the ears.
Which ended in revolution has proved to everyone that a revolution is within the bounds of possibility, and this struggle, which takes place worldwide, has to be supported by all means, and the rest is secondary. The party of the communists was right to adapt that worker name communist, even if it doesn't achieve everything that I would like it to. It will nevertheless enlighten the path of the civilized countries for at least a century. Its ideas will slowly be adopted by the people in the same way as in the 19th century the world adopted the ideas of the French Revolution. This is the colossal achievement of the October Revolution.
That's a lot of revolutions there. I would not forget to mention that in the summer of 1920, as Librev mentions, Kropotkin was visited by a delegation of English workers. Kropotkin handed a long letter to the delegation addressed to the workers of Western Europe. In this letter, he wrote that the workers of the civilized world and their friends and other classes ought to prevail on the governments to abandon entirely the idea of armed intervention in Russia, which was currently happening, including American involvement.
Yay.
Did you know that we invaded Russia in 1920?
I actually did not know that.
No, we put in like 8,000 troops. 8,000 Americans invaded Russia. That's why they're a little hostile.
I assume
non-trustworthy.
I assume we were on the side of the White Army.
Mm. Oh, yeah. The other thing was like in the treaty negotiations at Versailles, it was maybe it was the Soviet government or maybe it was the liberal one. But they proposed a ban on bombardment or aerial bombardment of civilian targets in war, right? And who do you think objected to this being put in the treaty?
Oh, probably the same country that objected to the UN declaring food to be a human right. Was it us?
It was. Okay, moving on, I want to skip ahead. Basically, a meeting is arranged for Lenin to kind of pop in on him. Life was hard in Moscow in 1918. Petrar, which I'm going to call him from now on, that's Kropotkin's first name, accepted the offer of his friend Usuev to live in his house in the city of Dimirov. In the spring of 1918, it's basically background, don't really need it. Although his health was always a struggle, Petrar still tried to participate in local public life. He spoke at a teacher's congress, participated in a congress of farmers' co-ops, and he vehemently supported the idea of establishing a regional museum. I constantly kept Vladimir Ilyich, that's Lenin, informed about Kropotkin's living conditions and also about my conversations with him. Ilyich, I'm just going to call it say Lenin, had a great respect for Petrar, and he held him in great esteem, particularly as the author of a book about the French Revolution. Moving forward, he saw his work as classical, meaning necessary, and he was certainly necessary to republish his book in wide circulation to distribute it free to all libraries. At the end of April 1919, I wrote him a letter, which is still kept in the Kropotkin Museum in Moscow. Here's this. Dear Petra, I heard from Miller that you intend to come to Moscow. That is a splendid thought. Lenin sends, V.L., so shorthand, sends his regards and told me he'd very much like to meet you. Could you telegraph me to your coming to Moscow? Blah, 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 setting up a meeting. The bits and pieces of history, people being normal. Okay, would you like to start with the dialogue of their meeting
sure.
As best as this guy Miller seems to relate? So it's still kind of secondhand. It's obviously not recorded, but it's still kind of fun. It's like it's hard to know, like, how do you relate all of this? Did you just kind of write down what you guessed of what they said?
No.
Anyway. But it's still fun to read, so go on.
So, how glad am I to meet you, Lenin? You and I have different views. We have different points of view about a whole series of problems, both as far as the execution and organization is concerned. But our goals are the same, and what you and your comrades are doing in the name of communism pleases me very much and makes my already aging heart happy. but now you are making life hard for the cooperatives, and I am in favor of the cooperatives.
We are also in favor of them, he explained loudly. Only we are opposed to cooperatives behind which kulaks, big landowners, merchants, and private capital hide. We only want to tear off the mask of these pseudo-co-ops and give the opportunity to big layers of the population to participate in real ones.
I do not want to dispute that. And where that is the case, it obviously needs to be combated by all means, just as lies and mystification need to be combated everywhere. We do not need veils. We have to uncover every lie without mercy. But there in Dimitrov, I have seen that more than once members of the cooperatives are being persecuted, who have nothing in common with those you are talking about a minute ago. And that is because the local authorities, who are perhaps the revolutionaries of yesterday, just like all authorities, have become bureaucratized, have transformed into officials who wish to do with their subordinates whatever they want, and who think that the whole population is subordinate to them.
We are always and everywhere against officialdom, Vladimir said. We are against bureaucrats and against bureaucracy, and we have to eradicate this aging mess completely if it grows up in our own new society. But surely you understand, Petrar, that it is very difficult to change people, since the most inaccessible fortress is surely, as Marx used to say, the human skull. We take all kinds of measures in order to be able to face this, and life itself obviously teaches us a lot. Our lack of culture, our illiteracy, our backwardness are, of course, noticeable. But nobody can blame us, as a party, as a state power, for all that is going wrong in the institutions of power, and much less for what happens far away somewhere in the countryside, at a great distance from the center here.
Of course, that is no consolation for those who are exposed to the exertion of power of that backward kinds of authority. And that authority in itself is already a terrible poison for anyone who exercises it.
But there is nothing we can do about that, he added. You cannot make a revolution with velvet gloves. We know very well that we have made a great many mistakes and that we will make a great number more. Everything that can be corrected, we will try. We admit our mistakes and often our great stupidities. Despite all mistakes, we are carrying our socialist revolution to a successful end. But please do help us. Share all the mistakes you can see, and rest assured that every one of us will look at it with great attention.
Neither me nor anyone else will refuse to help you and your comrades wherever that is possible. We will tell you about all the mistakes that are happening, which cause loud groans in many places.
No groans, but screams from resisting counter-revolutionaries, whom we all and remain utterly opposed to.
Now you are saying that we cannot do without authority, but in my opinion, it is possible. You should see how such an anti-authoritarian beginning flares up. In England, for example, I was just informed about this. Dock workers in one of the ports have established a wonderful, completely free cooperative, where workers of all other factories come and go. The cooperative movement is important to a great extent. Yes, it is the essence.
Miller speaking now, writing. I looked at Vladimir Ilyich. His gaze contained an element of irony and amusement. Listening very attentively to him, he was clearly amazed that while the revolution of October had expanded so enormously, that it was still possible to talk only about cooperatives, and yet more cooperatives. And Petrar kept talking and talking. He told us how somewhere else in England, another cooperative had been established, and how somewhere else in Spain, some other little cooperative federation had been established. Mondragon, perhaps? And how the syndicalist movement in France was developing. That is very harmful, Lenin, who could not restrain himself any longer, interrupted. By not devoting any attention to the political side of life, and by splitting up the working masses, one distracts them from the direct fight.
But the professional movement unites millions, and that in and of itself is a colossal factor. Together with the cooperative movement, that is a big step forward.
That is all very nice, Lenin interrupts. Of course, the cooperative movement is important, but if it is only as a syndicalist nature, it is harmful. But is that really the essence? Can only that lead to something new? Do you really think that the capitalist world will pave the way for the cooperative movement? capitalism will try to take power over these co-ops by any means necessary. This anti-authoritarian co-op group in England of English workers will be crushed in the most ruthless way possible and will be made into servants. They will depend on capital via a thousand threads so that the newly created thread, which you sympathize so much with, will be caught as in a spider's web. Pardon me, but all of that is unimportant. Those are all details. What is needed is direct action of masses. And so as long as that is not happening, nothing can be said about federalism, communism, or social change. Those are all child's toys, prattling without any firm ground under our feet, without power, without means, and it does not bring us any step closer to any of our aims. Lenin was standing up now and said all of this by raising his voice in a clear and vivid way. Petrar was leaning backwards and listening very carefully to him, his flaming words, and did not speak about the co-ops anymore after that.
"Of course you are right," he said. "Without struggle, you cannot get there, not in a single country, without the most desperate struggle."
"But only massively," he exclaimed. "The struggle and attempted murders of individual people serve to nothing, and it is time the anarchists understand that. Only in the masses, only by the masses, only with the masses, all other methods, including the anarchist ones, have already been filed in the archive by history. They are useless. They serve for nothing. They attract nobody, and they are only a distraction for people seeking their salvation on this long beaten path." Lenin suddenly went silent, smiled very engagingly, and said, "I beg your pardon. I am letting myself go too much, and I am tiring you. But we Bolsheviks are all the same. That is our problem. This is our pet subject, and it is so dear to us that we cannot speak about it without getting excited."
"No, no," Kropotkin replied. "If you and your comrades think in this way, if the power is not going to their heads, and if they feel that they will not be going in the direction of oppression by the state, then they will achieve a lot. Then the revolution is in truly good hands."
"We are doing our best," he replied good-heartedly. "We need developed masses. And I would so much like to see that book of yours, The Great French Revolution, printed in an edition as large as possible, for that book is useful for everybody."
"But where would I have it printed? It is not possible to print it at the state publishing house." "Well..."
"Yeah, this is still you."
"If you consider the book interesting and useful, I am prepared to print it in a cheap edition. Maybe we will find a cooperative publishing house that would accept it."
"That won't be a problem," Lenin said. "I am sure of that." After the conversation between Petrar and Lenin receded a bit, Lenin looked at his watch, got up, and said that he had to prepare for a meeting at the Congress, or the state, the government building. He said farewell to Petrar in the most cordial way and said that he would be happy to receive every letter of his. Petrar bowed us farewell too and went outside. We showed him to the door together. "How old he has become," Vladimir said to me. "Now he is living in a country that is bursting with revolution, where everything has been completely turned upside down, and he cannot think of anything else but to talk about the cooperative movement. There you have the poverty of ideas of the anarchists and all those other petty bourgeois reformers and theoreticians, who at this, you know, armchair activists."
Right.
Let me see where I'm going with this. "Who at this moment of massive creative activity, at the time of a revolution even, are never able to come up with a good plan or a good practical advice. For if we did what he says, but for a minute, then tomorrow we would have the autocracy back in power, and we would all, including himself, be chattering around a street lamp, and he only because he calls himself an anarchist. And how well he wrote. What wonderful books. How refreshing. How precisely did he formulate, and did he think. And now that is all the past, and nothing is left. But of course, he is very old, and we must surround him with care and help him with everything he needs. But the needs to be dealt with very delicately, very carefully. He is very useful and precious for us because of this whole terrific past and because of everything he has done. Please do not lose sight of him. Please take care of him and his family," he's talking to Miller. While we were continuing our talk about Petrar and the people of his generation, Vladimir and I were walking across the Kremlin in the direction of the government building, where in a quarter hour, the next session of our government was to start. So this is the source of V.V. Brockbrigic collected works in three parts. Part 3 is Reminiscences of Lenin between 1970 and 24. It concerns a written report by the Bolshevik Bronberg and the meeting between the two figures. Now, we only have a minute left. Actually, no, we have more than a minute. Any parting thoughts about this? There was a lot to digest there, so I'm just going to kind of let it kind of simmer in your mind as you finish listening to this.
I thought it was... I liked how the dynamic between Kropotkin and Lenin was overwhelmingly respectful. Like, they genuinely appreciated what each other was doing and how they were contributing. But Lenin was kind of frustrated because Kropotkin wasn't actually making the same type of real meaningful change that Lenin was by leading an actual revolution.
It's also a split between Lenin, who's now the head of state, more or less.
Right.
And he's the inside, and now Kropotkin is still an outsider. So you have a conversation between two guys who are acting, at least as far as polite society, as two old friends, and they're having political argument, but also catching up, you know.
Yeah.
And but also kind of reminds me of, like, my show and a lot of other shows where we kind of talk about these individual projects. This co-op is developed. Oh, look how cool it is. Look at the potential of co-ops. I do it on my own show. And at the same time, it's like, well, without the big project, where's it all going? Like, you know, you have academics like the old Marxists that I like, who are still voting, they're still going to vote Democrat, and they don't do a project that's electoral or anything like that. Their project is just trying to educate people about these issues, because they spent their whole life basically being on the back foot, being, under the McCarthyite regime of don't be too far to the left or you might get fired.
Would you say that the Green Party is a little more anarchist than, say,
than people let on?
The DSA and that the other groups are a little more...
Well, the main argument is that since we're being electoral parties that put people, you know, when we succeed, which we have, we currently have 128 elected Greens, which are probably more than DSA elected people. Endorsed people. The DSA should definitely have a number of, like, how many endorsed candidates win. But, of course, they're just endorsing Dems that have other infrastructures behind them, not just the DSA. This goes for AOC, and this goes for the squad.
A reminder that word of mouth is the best thing to do, your part in growing the show and the number of like-minded people. You can leave a review on the podcast platforms where this show is listed and share the three lefts via your chosen social media platform, with the most effective means being in real life. We are on Facebook and Twitter. To support the show more materially, visit our Patreon page and become a member there. All money raised will go to outreach as a specific goal. Links are currently found in the show description. Sources for each episode are in the show info tab and listed on our website, threelefts.news. A full backlog of episodes are also there, along with other info and sources. This has been Dan Platt. Be well.